As our panelists are reassembling, I have lots of questions here. I'm going to try and sort through, try and get them. There's a number of questions that are very specific to wanting more information about how DBT works. There's several like that. There's a few like that, very specific on can you answer a specific question about mentalization-based therapy. We may be able to get to some of those questions. I may not get to all of them. I would encourage, if you had a pressing question that does not get answered, feel free to approach myself, the other experts, so we could at least briefly respond to some of those questions. There are also occasionally questions that seem like they're very personalized to situations, struggling with a particular individual and kind of a what-to-do sort of question. One thing I'd like to remind everyone, or at least let you know again, we will have a couple of clinicians near the registration table after the conference who can direct you toward resources, at least in this local Connecticut area. So for those who are looking for resources or looking for, you know, where can you get treatments, we can at least give you some leads. And if there's a specific question like that about getting someone to treatment or something like that, you could also bring that there and speak about that, and we'll see what we can do. Certainly these are very challenging questions. We have a question that came in that kind of picks up on what was being discussed in the last session. It's for young adults who have already achieved a level of emotional regulation through DBT treatment, but still grappling with issues of identity and relationships, career choice. Do you believe DBT or MBT may be more helpful in these later stages of treatment? And I think that sort of idea, which was coming up in the last panel, could lead us.
I can speak to that from a...
Please.
Just in a... You know, from a DBT perspective... What I think we would say is, if a person has benefited from DBT so far, stick with it. Why would you want to get rid of it at that point? And I would say the same, if somebody's made progress that you say is halfway with MBT, stick with it. I mean, unless and until you've plateaued. If you plateau and you can't make any, then sure, try something different. But I don't think there's anything inherent about either treatment. I mean, that's the nice thing about, I guess one thing that I would say, one of the nice, very nice things about MBT and DBT, is they were both explicitly developed to treat people with very severe problems, unlike most other treatments that were developed for, you know, ordinary problems of living and then adapted for more severe. And I think both MBT and DBT have data that are good enough to show that they can take people from that level of severity and at least sometimes, unfortunately not 100% of the time, but sometimes all the way to quite normative, high-functioning status. And then, of course, leaving people along the way, you know, not everybody benefits. So unless and until either treatment fails, you know, the person stops making progress, I think it would be absolutely inappropriate to switch. You know, that's, you know, either case. And I would say that for any treatment, you know. I don't know.
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, the only other thing that we're trying to look at is that because we offer an 18-month length, in many ways, some people say, well, that's very short. Other people say it's very long. But for financial health care, it's very long. And what you don't want to do is have someone in a year or 18 months treatment where actually their trajectory has plateaued at the six-month point or something. And so we're trying to look at patient sort of response trajectories so that we can see whether we can pick things up early and see whether they're plateauing. We're just developing that at the moment. The problem is working out actually what might tell you when they really are stuck, you know, how long you have to wait and what are the good predictors for that and so on. But we're trying to look at that so patients are not caught up and therapists are not caught up. Therapists tend to want to soldier on, you know, over the cliff, really, almost, you know, because they've always feel they'll, some point we'll make a little breakthrough or something, and actually I suspect that's probably bad therapy. You have to stop at some point.
The panel, the hope is to do future directions, and that certainly sounds like an area that would be important to develop. I want to I'm going to do my best to facilitate the conversation to focus on from where we've started and what we've seen. Related to this question on switching from one to the other was what we ended with before on patient matching and that sort of thing. And in terms of future directions, would anyone care to comment on, you know, we don't know, how would you envision going after that sort of question? What would be the next step if there was to be an answer to that kind of question that comes up?
I just want to address that question maybe in a different way, which is that I think one of the things that we haven't discussed so much on this particular matter is what the patient wants. And I think that an organization like this one that really seeks to educate people, consumers and their families, and other providers that might be able to just provide information before someone chooses a treatment, I think that does have an impact on what should be assigned to the person. And I can say that, you know, I've worked with people of varying degrees of severity in their symptomatology and varying degrees of their functioning, and I'm not sure that that predicts which treatment should be used. And I most often go with what they're looking for. And I can say that I've had a person that started treatment in a place of severe suicidality, but is a very high-functioning person with, you know, doctoral-level degrees, doing quite well in her professional life and social life, but still uses DBT to help herself organize around very difficult interpersonal issues. And I think the same can be said of MBT to kind of enhance the use of whatever skills or process over time, I think, is going to lend some more stability.
It might be an interesting, again, if we keep bringing it back to research questions, it might be a very interesting research question of does the preference of the individual predict something about functioning? If you match that way, would you see better outcome as a possibility? I'm wondering whether people would comment on that from a research perspective. At our panel right now, we have Drs. Lois Choi Kane, Robin Kissel, Sarah Reynolds, and we have Jill Rathis, who is not listed on, I don't believe in your program, I think we have it listed as Shireen Rizvi, who is having some very wonderful family things. Her family is expanding, one could say, but she's well but not with us today, and Jill Rathis was graciously came in her stead. So in terms of research, just to think, and if we were to think about future directions, where one might go from this conference, would anyone care to add to that or other thoughts about this kind of idea, perhaps based on things we saw in the conference or just speculating?
I agree very much that I would want patients to be educated about both so we could take patients' preferences into account. But in terms of research at this point, one of the things I'm realizing from this conference is that I don't think there are too many generalizable research recommendations that can generalize to both treatments because the treatments themselves are at very different stages of development. There's two RCTs for MBT, so I think one of the first things would be more RCTs with adherence coding and additional ones by groups other than the treatment developer. And then the questions of external validity haven't yet been addressed in MBT, so more settings, more populations. And then the evaluation of training in MBT. And I think more of a need still to address therapist factors in MBT as well, which we've started to look at already in DBT. Because DBT is just an older treatment and has 15 RCTs already, we've looked at questions of external validity, other populations, different applications for different diagnoses, comorbid diagnoses. We've already done components analysis studies, started to look at mechanisms, and we've looked at therapist factors. And I think MBT might have to do a little bit of catching up before we can start looking together about common factors and that kind of thing. I do think that a risk for DBT is that it might have it might start to become all things to all people, because there's kind of DBT for everything now. And I think we have to be careful not to lose the focus on what kinds of problems it treats. Then I think eventually it would be really important to look at predictors for both treatments, what works for whom, or even a randomized controlled trial assigning some people to have a choice over MBT or DBT and other people not to have a choice but to be assigned, and see if the choice itself predicts better acceptability and better outcomes.
If we were to, just picking up on that, and I invite other people to come in, one thing that it sounds like could be drawn from this is that if there were similar studies of MBT that have been done of DBT, that might be a comparison point. Would the same mechanisms of change appear in a study of MBT, that might be a direction? I'm wondering if other people want to comment on some of these thoughts. And also within this conference, hopefully there may have been some hypotheses on what we might see. Would we expect those same mechanisms of change to show up? Different things? Were there be anything in particular based on the commonalities we've seen? That any comments on this? Just on where this might go. If there was a dissertation out there on this, yeah. If someone had sessions to work with or something like that, what might be the way to approach it?
Well, I wouldn't say this is necessarily a dissertation, but I do think that one thing we've come back to again and again is that the commonality of these treatments is the sense that there is just, I guess, a premium placed on understanding the client, validating the client, coming at it with humility. And, you know, there's certainly been other studies showing the importance of validation, even though they were originally developed as control groups. And so I feel like that is going to be something that could be explored, whether it's in this context, but I also feel like it could be something to think about teaching just in general for working with this client population. And maybe that's not unique to this client group, but it does seem that it's such a group that feels and has been so highly stigmatized that, you know, kind of emphasizing that what I would call the validation and acceptance end seems to be common to both, for sure. And just one other quick comment about what could be common is I think my own sort of pet theory about this is about one reason people have liked DBT is because of the emphasis it places on therapists having support, getting supervision and consultation, and, you know, the consultation team is a key part of the treatment. And that also seems to be something that is definitely present in MBT. And when you think about it, most of the research trials of studies that have been shown to be effective, they all sort of have this emphasis about therapists getting supervision and help and working in some form as a team, whether it ends up as something that is disseminated in a manual or not. So I feel like that may be something that's just a generally important thing as well, is just having that component of support for therapists so that we can continue to be validating and we can continue to, you know, not be burned out.
Is there a comment?
Different? Yeah. Okay. Well, just on the research question, I think that there's important avenues of further research in treatment outcome studies, and I think there's also a lot of work to be done in just understanding the psychopathology that people are coming to the table with. And so I think that, you know, what's difficult is that it's a trade-off. There's only limited resources. And for us to kind of really hone the questions of how these mechanisms work so that we can understand, as Anthony was saying, what can be discarded, because I think that there's a practical matter here. And what I like about both treatments is that the attitude towards treatment is practical. It is based on people getting better and getting a life that they can function in. And what I think that we need to understand better is not just which treatment reduces what symptoms, but how. And I think that we can do that in treatment outcome studies, but also understand the relationship between things like self-harm or suicidality and kind of some basic interpersonal phenomenon like attachment or rejection sensitivity, which is something that came up in the role play that we're studying in our family study. So those kinds of things, I think, can also enhance our understanding of what treatments work. And the last thing I'll say is that I'm not always sure that kind of head-to-head comparisons of treatment using research is the way to go. I don't think it's not productive, but I think that sometimes the punchline is really a lot of different things work in different ways.
I'm wondering if other panelists would say more about that, because I think that's a common question. I think that that might be coming to mind for people at the conference. Well, wouldn't that be the obvious next step, and why that would or wouldn't be?
You know, this is complicated, because I think that those questions come from my perspective, and Anthony, I'm curious if you'd agree or disagree, but a rather, I think, a simplistic way of thinking about the world. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but of course we want to know what's the best. But in fact, as a dialectical person, I'd say the best for what, in what circumstances, and for whom, and what day of the week, and these things matter. Even treatments that don't work well compared to other treatments have some successes. Mm-hmm. And even treatments that do work well consistently against other treatments have some failures. And so I think we owe it to the people that we fail. I'm not saying that patients are failing, that we are failing them by not having, as a community of researchers, as in a community of therapists, we do not yet have a sufficient number of treatments with sufficient flexibility so that even if you put them through every treatment, everybody would get well. We don't have that. We haven't achieved that. So I think rather than searching for a simple answer like which one works better, you know, 52% versus 53%, or, you know, or, you know, maybe it's 55% versus 60%. Whoa, you know, I mean, I don't know. And maybe it's not, you know. I don't think that's the most productive way to look at it from the patient's perspective. So I really kind of agree with what Lois was saying. That doesn't mean that a comparative study couldn't be very useful, however. And the reason it could be useful is because it could allow us to compare mechanisms. Mm-hmm. When you've got a randomly assigned sample of patients, and they're randomly assigned to do different treatments, I think that's actually a great design, not because I'm interested in the outcome, but because I'm interested in, then we can compare the same set of patients across processes. That, I think, is well worth doing, personally. It's very hard to do that without everybody really being excited about the outcome differential. That's the trouble. Everybody's looking for the horse race, and I think it's the processes that right now where we need to focus, because the processes are the things that are going to move us forward.
I'm wondering, we have some questions about some things that might relate to mechanisms, and I'm wondering if panelists might say, if there was to be, what kind of study, what kind of research, this might relate to what you were just describing. One question was asking about what a hyperactivated attachment system, you know, what that is. There's another one that brings up dissociation as compared to hyperarousal as different things that might be problematic in a therapy. And I'm wondering whether people can speak to some of these ideas that get tossed around, and if they were studied, perhaps similar to what Alan's describing, what would that look like? If we had slides saying, oh, here, this is showing it, what would we actually need to do to get at those mechanisms? How would you study it?
Just a comment first. Before we can even get there, we've got to do better with our measurement. Our measurement stinks.
Absolutely.
Please. I mean, even within DBT, we have measures of emotion regulation. We have measures of mindfulness. And they're only, at best, okay measures. And I don't know what there is in terms of measuring attachment and measuring mentalizing. I don't know if there are measures that are valid.
Can you actually, for the sake of our audience, yeah, can you say a little bit more about that this idea that mindfulness, we have okay measures.
Yeah.
What would we need to have a useful or a functioning measure? What's holding us back in kind of getting to this? My hope is to see, can we figure out what are the next steps
Well, I think one of the difficulties I find in doing research is what are the conditions in which people are doing research versus having problems in their real life? And so when someone's answering a questionnaire in a white room with a research assistant, is that necessarily going to bring to mind the issues that they're having in their lives? So sometimes certain kinds of measures have different benefits and drawbacks. But one of the things I did want to bring up is a measure that I was involved in a study with Carlin Lyons Ruth, and this is about a measure of attachment. What we did in this study was we asked mothers and daughters to come to the research lab together, and we facilitated a conflict discussion. And so it was actually a very funny experience where we had a conflict checklist. So what do you think are on the checklist of things that cause conflict between moms and daughters? What? Anything. Jobs, friends, drugs, things like that. And so we got them to talk about a subject in a structured way, and we videotaped it, which was coded for attachment features, how much attachment disorganization there was. And we also measured cortisol responses. And what was interesting about the outcomes in this study, and they're under review now, but the way that I thought of one of the measures where we looked at the quality of the relationship between the mother and the daughter as reported by the daughter, those who reported that they could confide in their mothers, like talk about anything, they had more robust sense of identity on a separate measure. And those who found their mothers effective in moments of crisis had better cortisol stability in the face of stress. So this is kind of one behavioral way that we get at how someone functions in a time that has clinical relevance. And so I think there's a lot of possibilities for using these kind of behavioral attachment measures pre and post treatments like mentalization that's very much focused on improving attachment functioning and kind of related stress reactivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got to get our measures in house in order, really, because the house is in disarray at the moment, and certainly they have to be a bit more specific and more representative of the actual disturbance you're trying to help someone with. And people are also, the problem with the attachment measures, as you and I have discussed so often, they're quite complex, they're time-consuming. They can be reasonably robust, actually, and reliable, but you have to do it incredibly carefully. It's quite expensive then, mm-hmm. and so on. So it gets quite problematic for everyday research, certainly. But we need to get it in order. I mean, we can't even agree what self-report questionnaires to use, so we could combine everything in some way. You know, we haven't even agreed that, which is pretty hopeless of us, frankly, as a scientific community, I would say. You can have a secondary emotion of guilt there, all of you, you know, but we all do. You say, oh, no, we don't think that's very good. We say, what do you think's good? Well, what about that? Oh, I don't think that's very good. You know, we had a whole national group that was set up to just decide on this so we could collect a core set of data. And did we come out with anything? No. And you had one in America, you may remember. I don't know whether you were on it, Alan. It was about 5-6 years ago. What did he come up with? No agreement. You know, and this is a major problem just for basic research. But I do agree with you about horse race study. They tend not to give you much information that's useful in the end for a lot of cost. Is one of the problems. And just one brief thing, though, interesting things that do come out of some psychotherapy research. Patient preference is an interesting phenomenon, and our politically correct sort of managers love patient preference because it looks very, very good and so on. And actually, I think it's a great thing. But actually, it doesn't often give what people hope, which is if you choose, you get better outcomes. It doesn't. A few people have tried to look at it in psychotherapy research and not found it particularly significant. But there's an interesting paper recently in the British Journal of Psychiatry where they looked at not so much patient preference, but the assessment for suitability. Because that goes on in borderline personality disorder as well, assessment for suitability for DBT or coming in, motivational interview. You know, in the UK, in those services, only something like 30% of patients got into the treatment because they were not suitable. They wouldn't sign the contract. You know, all sorts of problems and so on. And in this particular study, they did CBT in a dynamic treatment and assessing for suitability and noting. They were then randomized, actually, so then they could look at who got what they were suitable for, who got what they were not suitable for. And it made a difference in outcome in the dynamic therapy, but not so much in the cognitive therapy. Mm-hmm. We suggest, actually, if you're just going to have anything, you better have the cognitive one, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah. Addressing that, I think the difficulty with that kind of thing of what is a patient suitable for is that then we have to define what makes a patient suitable, absolutely, more suitable for one treatment. And I think sometimes I've seen people say that if you're more cognitively complex or more verbal or more insightful, you might be more suitable for a mentalization type or psychodynamic type treatment. But I think there are factors across the board that make people just more suitable for psychotherapy, period, and more responsive to psychotherapy. So I think even defining who would be more suitable for MBT versus DBT, I think it's not obvious, and it's tricky.
I don't think you can do that. No, you can't do it.
Are there any variables that, from the DBT perspective or the mentalization perspective, that you would consider putting forth in a study as a suitability question? I mean, it's obviously hypotheses, but would you kind of reject the question, is what I'm hearing?
I'd reject the question. At this point, it's premature.
It'd be, okay.
Can I come back to the last one, just for
yes,
a final comment? I just want to pick up on something Lois said and just disagree a little, because I think that there are things that we get out of basic research in the laboratory, although I have to say, we don't wear white coats and our building is really dingy. But I think there are things that we get out of those basic research that are building blocks. They're cheap studies. They're really inexpensive to do. Mm-hmm. And you can eliminate a lot of stuff really, really well and efficiently. And the things that stick through after 5 or 6 or 10 studies, you can then take to a more expensive patient population and be very open, you know, with very few exclusion criteria and very generalizable to the folks that we all actually work with. I think there's real value in those basic studies. I think they're cheap and they're...
Could you offer an example so we can kind of get a sense of what you're talking about? And that might also stimulate, what might be a next step in kind of taking these conversations forward? Please. One sort of example of how one might do that or have...
For example, I mean, our relatively simplistic, you know, give people math problems that they can't solve, get them hyper-aroused, then validate them or invalidate them. And we've replicated that now with borderline and non-borderline. They started out with a normal population, normal distribution. Now we've replicated it with compared a borderline to a non-borderline. And then we've gone further and say, okay, and then under this state of activation, high arousal, how do they respond? Can they discriminate affect in other people's faces? Things like that. Now, that's not yet treatment, but it's now I'm only 4 steps away from a treatment implication instead of 9. And they've been cheap studies. I mean, they're unfunded, shoestring studies we could do in our lab. So I think that there's a good place for those. And that's how measurement gets developed, too. I'm pretty convinced that none of the important measures are going to be paper and pencil measures, but they're going to be challenge tests and situation tests around arousal and situational. And our field has not been good about those. They are expensive to do. But if you could do 2 of those and actually learn something instead of 30 self-reports, it's worth doing. So.
But I think I think we were actually in agreement. That's what I meant.
Thing.
Just to clarify, I meant just doing straight self-reports may not be as effective as doing something more behavioral, like kind of an experiential, applied test. So.
But
I appreciate the clarification.
But I think one thing we could do right away is collaborate a little bit. Like, you know, if you had your favorite measure, if you think that what you're capturing as a process, I would use it in a DBT treatment study, you know. And I'd be very interested to see, if we get any changes on those things, just as a side. And that would be interesting and not too complicated. And even if it were a challenge test, I'd be willing to do it. I think there are ways that we could collaborate on the process more than the outcome. And last word on the outcome, just because I'm a pain in the butt about methodology, is that, you know, you have to have a comparison treatment at this stage with 2 empirically supported treatments, you have to power it for equivalence, which is hundreds and hundreds of patients. So, because
So can you actually explain what that means? That in order to figure this out, whether one's better than the other, explain what that issue is? if you would?
I'm sorry?
Explain what that issue is, okay, of having to power it for equivalence.
Well, the idea is that, you know, there's a certain random stuff that happens. And when you're comparing two things that work, you know, the question is, how do you know what's by chance? And two things that you expect to work pretty well, you expect them to be equivalent. You've got to have a lot of people to decide that they aren't equivalent, that they've that they aren't just those random differences of a few percentage points aren't just random. And so it's hundreds of patients.
Right. So whereas in relatively small studies, 20 to 50, 100 patients, sure, you can show that something works, but to show that one treatment actually outperforms another treatment, it's a whole new order of magnitude.
When they both work.
When they both work. And you get into huge problems. I mean, multi-site problems anyway, to kick off. But and not just whether the therapy is being delivered as it should be being delivered, but, you know, when you say, well, okay, we have to start right from the beginning here because, for example, MBT therapists are trained for 3 days and then chucked in our trials with once-a-week supervision with four for an hour. Okay, so that's what they get. But if I say, well, we've got to do it equivalently so that you can only have 3 days DBT training from start, you know, you can't, and so on, and you can have 1 hour a week, so you've all got the equivalent, you know, so everyone's getting the same input. You know, you can have your consult because that's our supervision. But the thing gets so amazingly complex that nobody can, you never quite do it. You know, because then you say, well, they won't be able to deliver DBT if they only get 3 days. I'll say, you know, well, they can't have 2 weeks plus this, that, and the other because that's crazy. We can't do that. Do you see what I mean? It's not generalizable. The whole thing is a nightmare. Good luck to someone who wants to do it.
I'd like to take the conversation back to something that was being discussed in the previous session about to what extent might MBT therapy be doing things that would meet DBT and vice versa. Someone observed, how is MBT functionally so different from CBT? In practice, they appear similar. And it raised this, I brought up that question about kind of cross-adherence coding. I'm wondering if people could speak about whether that you would see that as productive or not, or that sort of idea about trying to see, do MBT believe that DBT actually are doing mentalization and vice versa? Would DBT say MBT is doing chain analysis in their sessions, for example? Would that be productive? Or a comment on that idea?
It would be more productive if we first established the mechanisms. Then we knew what mechanisms are working in either treatment. Then being able to see the extent to which maybe the other treatment does that better or doesn't do it as well, then there's some good reasons to do that.
You had mentioned a challenge study, even if MBT were to say, will you test this out and see if it functions in yours and vice versa? Any comments on what you would have the other study use in such a challenge? If an MBT measure were to be incorporated in the next DBT study, or vice versa, are there particular things that you would love to see assessed?
Mindfulness and emotion regulation. To the extent that we can measure that well. Yeah. You know, it's okay.
We may have an okay measure in the end of mentalizing. We've got a lot of data on a measure at the moment, which is...
That's a great start.
But it probably requires a stress test to go in with it, and we haven't worked out what that is, you know, just to see whether or not... And that would be great to see, because we could then see if DBT therapists actually shift that.
Right.
If it turned out that either, say, DBT did or didn't, or the other way around with the mentalization, what would that tell us, or what would be the next step? And I'll leave that question, but then also put it to, in general, future directions based on things you've observed in this conference, anything else. But let's start there. Let's say those studies were done, a DBT study with a mentalization, and it shows that it does mentalize or it doesn't mentalize.
Well, it's not just that it does or it doesn't, but that better mentalizers have better outcomes also,
okay,
that it's a mediator of outcome. Then we could start to look at, would it? Then the next question within DBT, again, not a comparison study, would be, well, what could we do to enhance that either by, you know, within the model or by, you know, adapting in some other way? Does that boost outcomes? Does actually. So, for example, I think, you know, we've all agreed that what I call relationship mindfulness happens sometimes in DBT, that overlaps with what you would call mentalizing. But if it turned out, for example, that that's pretty important, it's more important than we think it is, then we might do more relationship mindfulness. But we can stay inside the model and just do it more. Right now, there's nothing to tell us how much of that we should do. It's actually fairly idiosyncratic, I think. You know, the adherence doesn't say you have to do it this way or that way. So that could, we could boost. This is good for everybody. It's not a pitting of a treatment against another, but understanding mechanisms and enhance. I mean, neither treatment, I hope, is going to look the same in 10 years. They're both going to evolve, hopefully, in good directions, and hopefully according to data.
I would just add that I think I might like to see different measures as mediator measures, measures that we're giving throughout the treatment or at least several points during the treatment, and then outcome measures. So outcome measures, I'd be interested in ultimate emotion regulation and suicidality and depression and impulsivity and global functioning. But mediators that I'd like to see, and I suspect the end results would be similar, as appear to be so far, but the mediators might be different. The process of getting there might be different. And I think if we looked at some metacognitive-type measures, they may change more quickly in MBT, and I would suspect direct measures of affect regulation and behavior change would show quicker changes in DBT, but that ultimately they would lead to the same place, just in the way that affect, cognition, and behaviors are linked and transactional. And I think, you know, one is going more from a metacognition perspective, and through enhancing cognitive controls affects behavior and affect. And I think DBT does some of that for sure with mindfulness and dialectical thinking, but also works directly on the behaviors and the affective change more quickly, probably, or more directly, so they might change more quickly, leading to similar outcomes.
So those would be the sorts of questions there. Yeah. We have someone raising the issue of stigma as a barrier, as a potential barrier to treatment, but also as possibly a mechanism, is one of the reasons that treatment works, because the person accepts the diagnosis. Something along those lines. And I'm wondering if people would comment whether issues of stigma might be a mechanism of change, accepting diagnosis. Any thoughts about that? Or any way that next steps, anything about that? I could read the whole question, but it's basically, isn't the reason that the DBT works because the person accepts the diagnosis?
Well, again, there's no data on that. I think one thing that is relevant here is some of the research that people have done looking at the emotion of shame in borderline personality disorder and the relevance of that. And I can't remember if Milton's data showed was shame reduction related to treatment outcome.
Self-harm in the following week.
So if you want to say what it was.
Well, you're saying it fine.
Okay. Well, I just so I don't know how many people know about this study, but there has been some research. First of all, by Milton Brown in Marcia Linehan's lab, looking at the reduction of shame over the year of treatment in DBT, and it was linked with reduction of self-harm, significant reductions in self-harm if the shame was when shame went down over the treatment year. So I think that's definitely relevant to that question in terms of stigma. And then there's also been some recent efforts that I think some of you guys know about to focus specifically on shame that Shireen Rizvi has done, doing exposure to the emotion of shame. So, you know, certainly a lot of theorists have started to think that's a key element in DBT, but it could also be, for all we know, that gets reduced.
Absolutely.
In, you know, maybe for different reasons, right, or who knows what reasons in MBT.
Right. I think that they come from two different research literatures and traditions, and one of the things that I have had on my mind is the way that, you know, the kind of interest, commitment, and enthusiasm both groups of therapists have for working with this patient population. I think that makes a huge impact and is probably a common factor that helps people recover. And I think from the MBT point of view, it really has a lot to do with attachment, which is different than just alliance, because the theory of attachment is that the attachment experience helps people have secure the capacity to maintain stable relationships, but also to strengthen their self-regulatory capacities, like affect regulation, impulse control, attentional regulation, all the kinds of things DBT gets to in a different way. So I suspect that both treatments might actually facilitate attachment within the treatment relationship. And so far, there's only been one study, to my knowledge, the TFP study head-to-head with DBT in supportive, where they looked at changes in attachment, but that's one thing that can kind of be further explored.
There are a couple of questions asking about neurobiological findings or neuroimaging, genetic, other studies, and they're looking for comments on whether these need to be included in or should be included in psychotherapy research. Any comments on including those sorts of measures in research? What do you think needs to be done next?
Well, my reverent comment is you know, if we could do less of that, we'd have a lot more money for treatment research.
They're incredibly expensive, and one does worry slightly that that'd be even slightly more challenging. It's a bit like modern phrenology that worries me. You know, it's kind of, you know, it seems to have this credibility, but actually, you know. But look, it's expensive, but also it's really, really difficult to do properly. There's lots of problems with this, and there's lots of problems in the literature in it at the moment, whether it's to do with medication, whether it's to do with they've been treated with medication, just stopped it for 3 months or something like that, what effects this has. All these sorts of things are a problem. And don't look now, hormonal variation in women is quite common. It happens regularly each month and so on, and it has big effects on the actual effects in brain, blood flows and scanning data and so on. You have to take them the exact time in the same cycle. Hardly anyone's done that. Sabine Herpetz is trying to do that at the moment because actually it interferes completely with the data and so on. So I wouldn't jump in there. I know some people really, really want to, but you've got to be really careful, I think. Boy, is it expensive.
There's a question about any research on the success of intensive, and this question was on DBT residential programs for coping skills, 1 to 3 month period of time. I think the idea being kind of a condensed treatment. And I'm wondering whether across the, whether DBT or mentalization, the idea of a residential condensed treatment, thoughts about, is this an area for future steps, next steps? Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know about next steps. I think the data already exists in DBT anyway. I mean, there are there's a couple of studies coming out of Germany where longer-term stays are possible with the public health system, 90-day DBT treatments, which have been shown to be quite effective. And in this country, uncontrolled studies, but for adolescents and residential treatment programs, controlled but not randomized, looking at that have shown pretty good outcomes. So I think that they're there. The larger problem in the States is getting people to pay for it. Or, to be dialectical, or getting people to create intensive outpatient programs so that the residential programs aren't needed. Right. But that requires, they're both more expensive, you know, and so it's hard.
I also think just to put a bit of, there are one or two studies in Germany. It's about one of the few places where this actually exists. I'm never sure how they afford it, but apparently they do. I'm not that convinced that the outcomes for the intensity is kind of all that worthwhile. That's not, they're not reasonable outcomes at all. They're expensive, and actually, in general, I don't think it's the line to go for the future. I mean, if that's what we're talking about, I think that those sorts of intensives don't quite give the level of outcome you want to package it all in. And there may be many reasons for that. One is that it, as it were, takes the person out of their environment, tries to do something, and then puts them back in it. And there's a big problem with putting patients back into environments, having taken them out, and then them using those skills or using what they've gained, and whether or not it's robust enough and how it functions. I think that's a big problem for patients, actually. And it's certainly a problem for their ongoing care in our systems, in public health systems anyway. So it's not a direction I would recommend for us.
You know, and I think that speaks to the question of how we use research, what it implies, you know, because as someone who runs a residential program that is intensive, I'm not sure the reason we do it is about data. It's about clinical necessity, and it is expensive and unfortunately not widely available. But as we know, as you went over in your talk, sometimes these recurrent hospitalizations, which is the best a clinician can do in a clinical situation, is not helpful, in fact, harmful to a patient. And I think that's where residential settings can help, is to provide more of a kind of stabilizing transition and get them to the next step of where they are. And I think the problem for us is certainly what Anthony said, is that a lot of times people come to our program because they can't get specialized treatment where they live, or they've failed so many treatments and prolonged a lot of suffering and disruption in their life that they need to go to something high level. But the problem for us is certainly that they ultimately have to return to that. So it's, I think, becomes more of a clinical issue that I think is informed by research, but I don't think research can primarily answer that question completely.
Well, and adding to that, Lois, that even if you do have positive effects of the residential treatment, it's then how to sustain them and to generalize them into the outside world. And to do that, we have to have a more dispersed system of care that can receive these patients. I mean, you and I have been through this. Just when you try to discharge somebody and I can't receive them into our program because we're too full. Mm-hmm. And so then how do you keep the gains, if there have been gains, of a residential program?
Yeah, I think it's just the answer is there, you know, as much as we're talking about more money for research, there's just like thin resources for a population of people who can use treatment, can get better, but don't have enough resources.
I would just add that if you have 28 days, let's say, and someone is going to be in a residential or in an inpatient setting, I'd rather see them in a place like McLean or Silver Hill, or, you know, a place where there is a focused specialized treatment like mentalization or DBT, where they can really possibly enhance functioning, learn a great deal, and be more equipped to go outside and have follow-up treatment of the same. I'd rather see that than a place without that. Mm-hmm. But I agree very much about the generalization and the concern of taking someone out of their natural context and then sending them back. There would need to be the follow-up with the same treatment.
Right. We also have this problem of being risk-averse, you know, and so there are going to be people who are going to be mandated into inpatient, into residential treatment. And so it's going to happen, even though that, you know, some of us might prefer that not to be the case. But so if they are, I agree with Jill, let's make those at least specialized treatments that have some chance. And, you know, this is a public health problem, more than a research problem.
There was a question about applying MBT with lower functioning or cognitively impaired they also mentioned substance abuse, but I'm gonna ask to focus on the lower functioning cognitively impaired, and pose that both to the MBT and the DBT. Any comments of where we are? Anything that needs to be done next addressing those populations?
Well, I can say two sides of it, which is that in our program where we do both, you know, I think there tends to be sometimes, I don't know why this is a common perception, that less intellectual people might benefit from skills work, which I actually don't find to be true. DBT is highly sophisticated. And when we do the skills training, I think it can be pitched at whatever level people are at and can be adapted to their, you know, intelligence level, whether it's high or low. And I find the same to be true of MBT. MBT, it doesn't have as many things to remember. I mean, it's more of a process. And so, you know, being able to kind of engage in just expanding your awareness of your experience, whatever kinds of articulations you have, whether they're, you know, kind of high levels of vocabulary, low levels of vocabulary, that is not what's important in mentalization. It's more of the process of being aware of what your experience is and being able to represent that and describe that, rather than what kinds of levels of sophistication it involves.
We did have some data on this, but we sort of stopped collecting, just using the NART, you know, for looking at the reading test, you know, to look at, and we found no evidence that that had any influence at all in terms of looking at what happened or what people did. It didn't affect it. We had some pretty low readings, but we're in a very low educated area, in fact. So.
Yeah, DBT, the data say the same thing, that there have been now, there's at least one study, I don't know if it's published, that actually collected cognitive functioning, kind of IQ data, and pretty broad range, no differences between low functioning and high functioning, all within the normal or genius range, but not the MRDD range. And then at least two studies, not randomized, but with high functioning mentally retarded folks that showed good outcomes. So it's a pretty broad range of applicability there.
I think there's a follow-up question on something that was discussed around the assessment issues, and it was how might one behaviorally assess mindfulness? And perhaps this relates to other constructs that we're kind of struggling with. If we want to get away from paper and pencil and do this, anyone care to comment on the challenge about? And I think this could also apply to mentalization.
You're saying how what would be on a paper and pencil?
No. How might one behaviorally assess when people talk about these experiential tasks that really where everyone was sort of agreeing that those are the sorts of things that are really the future? How does that even look?
I'm thinking just the way there are analog tests to measure impulsivity, almost the opposite of that, the ability to focus on a certain stimulus perhaps, and not and let go of distractions. And so I can imagine some type of computer screen with various things, and distractions coming, and the ability to focus one's attention in the here and now.
And also there, in we have these talk aloud experiments, where people say whatever they're thinking out loud into a recorder, they're alone, and you can present challenges to them. You know, present them different scenarios. You can yell at them, call them names. You know, you can, depending on how sadistic you're feeling, you can do all kinds of things and see what happens. You know, now that it's not the problem with that, of course, is that it's under experimental conditions and the person's actually oriented to trying to do something different. So, you know, how well that actually represents what they do out in the world tomorrow evening is still the question. So these are hard things to figure out.
Is that a test of mindfulness? Because it sounds like a Stroop test, but slightly sophisticated, of attentional control,
More
than mindfulness.
Control.
Yeah, which is only a specific element. And that's where it gets complicated.
Right.
You know, that's why we were trying to, for the measure of mentalizing that was useful for everyday research, you know, not so you can do it through the RFQ, the reflective function, but that's so complex. But to do a reflective function questionnaire that has, it has clever sort of scoring, so you have to kind of rate yourself under certain circumstances. And then we wanted you to do it under stress. So where you score, where you mark yourself, as it were, just scoring 5 doesn't give you a good score, if you see what I mean. It could be 3.5 is good mentalizing in the question, if you see what I mean. So it's quite a complicated thing. But, again, it's only a proxy system. You know, so it's difficult.
I'm going to make a little bit of a shift and start throwing some questions that are not quite on topic but that are more applied. We have a number of these. One that just came in was, what about certification programs so that families can better assess clinicians' qualifications? Can anyone comment on that? I know that we're aware. So I'm shifting topic on you, but let's see what we do.
Okay. Within DBT, there's talk of and planning for certification of teams that will have several criteria, and there will be a training component to it, but also the team having, and then certain things that the team actually does, and then submitting tapes for adherence coding. So there will be a process to apply for certification, and it's in the works.
Yeah, one thing I'll add, there currently is an organization giving a DBT certification that is highly controversial. presently. So just there is definitely a consumer be warned going on. Anything on the side of certification or some way of establishing that someone is doing MDT?
Oh, we can probably establish whether they're doing it or not, but that's rather different from being some sort of organization of certification. Yeah. And
from a family perspective of wanting to make sure that or a consumer perspective of trying to find a therapist, is there any way to know that someone is actually doing the treatment? You know, does that exist, or is there any movement to create that?
Well, you know, the reason I laugh when the question was asked is that I wish I knew, you know, because, you know, like, I am someone who, like, specializes in this area, and being at McLean Hospital, you know, we can refer to people we know, but we don't know everyone. I mean, this is a great opportunity to meet other very nice professional colleagues. But what I've found is that you just talk to people that are available or in the person's area and see what you think of them. Because I think that while adherence is really important, especially in terms of a research agenda, perhaps, I'm not sure that's always the best way to select a therapist for your family member.
In DBT, it's a little bit different because there is a relationship between adherence and outcome. There may be, within adhering people, I think, of course, in programs, there's probably much more matching that needs and selection that needs to go on, but there are lots of people who say they're doing DBT that are not doing DBT the way the manual intends them to do it, and there's evidence that outcomes aren't as good then. And so it's kind of a consumer protection issue, really. It's not to sort of have a gold star, but rather for consumers to say, okay, this is a legitimate DBT program. There are lots of places, unfortunately, in the United States that they say it's a DBT program, and they, for example, just have a skill training group. And that's just one little piece of DBT. It's an important piece, but it's like saying, gee, I had triple bypass surgery when I had only anesthesia, you know? I mean, it's not the same, you know?
Well, and so, I mean, one start that I know some people do is you could just even ask simple questions like, you know, do you have a consultation team? Do you have, you know, just some basic things about the modes they have of DBT? Because I do think that's common, and it's not that there's anything wrong with having a DBT skills, but I think that it contributes to the perception that that's everything, as opposed to just sort of, it's kind of like what's in a name. Well, kind of a lot. And so just calling it DBT skills, I think, is a different thing than calling that DBT as a whole.
I think that the difficulty for consumers, though, is a serious one, but I don't know how it's best addressed, to be truthful. And, you know, we've tried, I've been writing the last 6 months, to attempt to get a sort of quality assurance-type document that you know, doesn't really cost anything, but does require people to say they're doing this, this, and this sort of sense. And then there may be ways in which they can get themselves sort of rated, at least, you know, as being adherent. Because we do have a reliable adherence system now, which we've developed, and it works quite well, as far as we can tell now. It's done mostly with the Scandinavians, actually, and it's working quite well. So, you know, we do have a way of showing whether people are or not, or whether something is. But how you protect the consumer in the end, I don't know. In the UK, you know, we'd have problems, and in Europe you have problems with, you know, what people call closed shops, or, you know, and all sorts of things. You're not allowed to control things. They have to be freely available and things. So it's a slightly different system, and it becomes a, you know, I don't want to be a world's policeman about MBT. I have no interest in that.
There was a specific question about parameters of telephone coaching, which would be DBT. I'm wondering if we could hear from both orientations the role of telephone in the treatment. What is that?
Oh, ours is fairly straightforward. We don't do telephone. Fundamentally, we try to make the patient or give the patient retain the responsibility for managing their own crises. So we only do telephone interaction, as it were, between in working hours, Monday to Friday. The rest of the time, they're on their own. And it's part of their one of our beginnings of the treatment, which we spend a session or maybe even longer on, spending quite a lot of time on crisis planning. So it's a whole mentalizing process about how they manage, you know, these, like the role play we had, that would be a sort of crisis planning system that you could use to develop how they're going to respond in this situation, what we can do, what we're expected to do, what they're expected to do, and that's all identified very carefully. And in fact, what we found is they rarely use the out-of-hours service. Fortunately, for one very good reason, is they're much worse than we are. They're more horrible to the patients in various ways at midnight than we are 9 to 5 in the day. And that very aversive sort of phenomena is very good for helping them maintain. I'm not saying it's a good thing. They shouldn't behave like they do. But so we just do a 9 to 5 thing and then the crisis planning for the rest of the time.
Just to elaborate on that, we do the same in that we have a 9 to 5, or I think it's 9 to 6, telephone access, and the patients can call and expect that if they're going to call and they're in crisis, that we will get back to them within the next 2 hours. But that said, when we do get back to them, the time, the connection on the phone is always limited to 5 or 10 minutes. It's never more than that. It's enough for us to kind of quickly assess things and just make contact with them. If they are truly in crisis, they are allowed to page us. But I must say, in the, 4 years that we've been doing this, I think we've been paged twice. It just doesn't happen. It seems to be that just knowing that they have access to that phone line and to us if they need us is enough to cause them to not use it very much.
And that was certainly true in an IPT study in New York with borderline personality disorder. They had a crisis phone system that the report of the patients, and it is published actually by John Markovitz, was that actually they hardly used it. In fact, I don't even know that they did use it. It was only about 12, 15 patients. But they said they really, really liked having the number in their pocket. You know, they didn't use it, but they just felt very reassured that it was around.
And sometimes they like to just leave us a message at like 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that, and knowing that we'll get it the next morning, you know, but that doesn't even entail any real contact with them.
This question went to Dr. Bateman, but I think it could apply to both treatments. It was about how would you have handled a situation where in the role play, Alice, when you asked if she felt like cutting the session, said yes, and she could not identify reasons as to why she had this urge. So I'm going to change the question to, when you have an urge for something like cutting and the person can't articulate where that came from, either in the session or out of the session, can anyone comment on what do you do with that in MBT or DBT? And why don't we start with MBT, if we would.
Okay.
If they couldn't answer the question, what would you do?
If they can't answer the question, then there's two things to do. One is to work out, was there any... you'd normally take it back to you that maybe... If she's saying yes, you're saying that I do feel like cutting myself.
Does feel like cutting, doesn't know why.
And they don't know why, what it is. Then I'm trying to make them explore whether there's anything that I'm doing in the session that might be creating something. So they have to focus out from their own preoccupation with cutting, as it were, or the thought of it, and actually consider, actually, what about me? What's he up to? What's he done? See whether that stimulates it. If it doesn't, then that's fine. Then you'd move back straightforwardly to actually try to empathize with actually the difficulty that applies, because you can actually have these urge and have no idea where it's coming from. And that's a really dangerous, difficult position to be in at any time, to have no sense of it. So I'd then empathize with that and then try and move off from there again.
Anything that, on a DBT perspective, you'd wish to add or do differently?
I'm not sure if this is how different this is exactly, but my initial response to this is, I think in part it's important not to think of it as why in DBT so much as trying to assess and understand the context over time and each link as things unfold over time. So even though that may seem like semantics, I think that it's kind of relevant semantics, because who knows why we do lots of things. But if, you know, you do want to try to get the client to report at what moment did you notice that urge. And if they can't answer it, I mean, I'm not sure what you guys would say. I think I think probably the important thing that I often work with, I don't know, people I'm supervising and so forth, is not to always just sort of accept I don't know and then just drop it. And I think to have a little bit of a relentless pursuit, but that just because they can't answer and give you detailed information, for example, in that role play, I think you still want to offer some hypotheses maybe, and, you know, you may, it depends on where you are in therapy, but at a certain point they'll have pattern, you know, a certain number of patterns of chain analyses, which essentially kind of creates your case formulation, and that can also provide some information because you still want to be able to try to offer some solutions and address some links in the chain, either relying on past chains, as I said, or the biosocial model, which means you're often going to be looking for emotional links in the chain.
Okay,
and I just add, we'd want to work on generalizing because if the person sort of has a urged in the middle of life somewhere and doesn't know where it came from, they still have to know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And so decreasing the secondary reactions to that, to approach that as with curiosity instead of something else, would be very useful. It actually would help bring arousal down. It's an opposite action kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That then, of course, then we would ask them, now that your arousal's down, now maybe you could do the chain that led to it.
Which sounds somewhat similar to what Anthony was.
I mean,
was,
we have what we call just rewind. So if it happens in the session, they don't know. You go back to where actually, but you'd normally take that first. Because normally, if they have that urge, we would suggest that they've lost their mentalizing. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's no good trying to get them to do a ton of it at that point in a complex way. So you have to rewind, get them out of their own non-mentalizing state. But the best way to do that, because it's self at the moment, is get them to over to other. So rewind and say, was there something I did then? What was it? Maybe I was saying this.
Right.
It just occurred to me that perhaps as I, you know, and then you try to identify the shift and then move them forward from that to see how they're managing. Because, you know, the idea that they have the curiosity at that point, you know, when they have it out there, for us, that's exactly what we want. When you have that urge out there anywhere, you keep that mentalizing. And that's what curiosity is it, where's that come from? Am I feeling like this? You know, whatever it is, that's what the mentalizing is.
If I can summarize this last point, what I'm hearing is from both perspectives, there's a very focused effort to determine how this occurred, perhaps looking in different directions slightly, the slants, we've talked about a slant this way, a slant that way, but there's that kind of effort. But from both Alan and Anthony, I believe I heard, and I think from Sarah, this idea that if they were really stuck, to start from a place of acceptance and to reflect back on the challenge of not knowing and help them sit with that, as opposed to continue, to take a little space off. And then once they're regulated in the different language, then perhaps come back and try to help them better understand. But to really pay attention to when to give them some room and just take it there, and then when to continue forward in understanding. Seemed like that was very common. And I'd like to say it's a nice moment to end on, I believe, where in our treatments, I'd like to confess I had no idea how these sessions would go in terms of putting these treatments side by side. I think I anticipated a lot more differences, a lot more of our experts kind of coming at things very differently. And I think what we found was that in their actual approach to patient care, in many, many ways, what we found was a lot of remarkable similarity in often in style, whether it was mentalization challenges or DBT irreverence. And I'm really very appreciative for all that were involved, all of our experts coming out and engaging in this process. I'd like to acknowledge that we're at the end of a day that I think was very stimulating. I think we're all a little bit tired from it. I congratulate everyone for being here. I'd like to thank everyone for putting the time in to learn more about this, to advance your own understanding, whether it's toward the aim of patient care, family care, whether you for yourself are trying to understand what treatments are out there. Thank you very much for being here. I think that's Akira Van Gelder, I believe, might be hanging around to sign more books. If people are interested, you could look for her outside. I believe there are more books available.
Can I just add your CE
applications for continuing education. Yes, Jill.
I just want to mention that from the perspective of the therapist, bringing us together for this conference was an incredible experience for us. I learned so much. I feel like my mentalization about the other approaches and how other approaches see us, it's greatly expanded my understanding of what can be done, and I've never experienced anything like that with others. So in terms of future, the more the better of this type of exchange and modeling. Really useful. Thank you.
And please, on your evaluations, if there are particular things that you'd like to see comparable to this, please put those in or other ideas. And thank you all so very much.
I was going to add.